welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 2nd of November 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. It's the start of another week, and we are here to discuss the news that's been going on in Britain over the past week, and who better to discuss that with than Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing very well, thank you very much. It's we're entering into the sort of last quarter, I suppose, of the year, and it's a period where there's going to be, I think, virtually unparalleled turbulence in our society as a result of the resurrection of lockdown, and the fact that so many people have seen it before, have lived through lockdown, have seen that lockdown doesn't work, and are now being expected to tolerate another period of lockdown in the hope that lockdown two will do what lockdown one failed to do. But my suspicions are that as soon as we start to relax after lockdown two, I think lockdown two will produce a sort of a dampening of the figures. But the point is, as soon as lockdown two is relaxed, in the same way that as soon as lockdown one was relaxed, so the virus and the spread of the virus returns. And so I think that we're going to go through a winter of giving the economy a second kicking without there being any benefit from it at the end of the day. Because at the end of the day, we're going to have to face the fact that this virus is going to be with us for some considerable time. But we will have gone through two lockdowns that will have severely damaged our economy. And the damage that is done to our economy may well prove to be far more deadly than the actual virus might have been had we just soldiered on through it in the same way that people tended to during the Spanish flu 100 years ago and the other viral infection, the other pandemics that have spread across the world at various intervals during the course of the last century. And so I think that what's likely to happen is that a lot of people are going to lose faith in the Conservative government. And yet there is nobody for anybody to turn to, is there? Because if we turn away from the Conservatives, then there is just Labour. And Labour has just been dealt a crippling blow by the results of the inquiry carried out by the Equalities and Human Rights Commission. And so there really isn't any viable alternative, and I think even the Conservative government is not really going to be a viable option either. So people are going to be really scratching their heads when the next round of elections comes up.
Yeah, we're entering into a winter of discontent. I mean, we've really got a lot of upheaval here. We've got this lockdown, as you say, it's not going to achieve any better than the first lockdown. So what is really the point of it? We really have to face up to this virus and stop damaging the economy and stop damaging people's lives that need to get treated in hospital. And at the same time, the Labour Party have now suspended Jeremy Corbyn. The Labour Party are split in half. And I believe next month we're leaving the EU as well, which will be leaving on World Trade Organization terms. So we're really at a point now where we've got huge changes that are occurring. And obviously the establishment is going to try and make whatever they can out of this, the same as they did with 9-1-1. You had this great tragedy and straight away they saw a chance to bring in lots of laws, lots of intrusive laws, snooping on people. And with this coronavirus, they've seen the chance that they can introduce this great reset and they can try and do away with cash. And then when they do away with cash and everybody has to use bank accounts, then it will be like the Chinese social credit system. And of course, if you criticize certain government policies, your bank account will be taken away, which is what we've seen happening with Mark Collette and Laura Towler and various others all around the world. This is happening. And then people won't be able to conduct any business transactions. How that is any different to China's social credit system, which works in exactly the same way, except it's all above board. And they say this is what we're doing. I mean, what's happening with the banks here in Britain with removing people's bank accounts, this just isn't being talked about apart from by independent people like ourselves. I mean, all sorts of things are going on. We've got the, we may have vaccinations that are forced onto people. This test and trace system, where they're tracking everybody, we might end up seeing ID cards. I mean, it's getting rid of all the small business owners as well. It's wiping out the middle class consolidating all the businesses under one big business. So people like Amazon are doing very well at the moment. And massive changes, I think, are going to occur this winter. You got any thoughts on any of those there, Max, and maybe some more on the Labour Party?
Well, the move away, first of all, the move away or the move towards a cashless economy is something which a lot of people speak about. And I have to admit that during the period of lockdown, I've tended to use my debit card a lot more and just to sort of contactless. That's right. Make contactless payments in a way that has become quite common just recently. However, I do deliberately go out every so often and take a chunk of money out of my account and carry it around in cash and spend it as cash, just so that I am actually contributing to the cash economy. Because I think that from a political perspective, the prospect of having a cashless society is so threatening to both our nation and to mankind in general, to be quite honest, because once you exist within a cashless economy, then you lose all privacy. The government will know whatever you spend, and they will know where you've been and when you spent that money and what you spent it on. Now, that may not bother most people most of the time, but there are going to be occasions when you're going to want to, when something embarrassing happens to you and you need to spend some money to have perhaps an embarrassing medical condition put right or something like that, the sort of medical condition you wouldn't want your local police officer to know about, or that you wouldn't want your local benefits agency to know about. But the point is that one of the other trends that's been taking place in recent years is that government departments have all been subscribing to a kind of a universal database. That's the idea. That they're subscribing to a universal database. Now, with a universal database, what it means is that if you have any issue with, for example, one government department, like, for example, if you've got an issue in terms of claiming benefits because you're due any benefits, then the person who's investigating your benefits claim will also be able to have a look at your medical records as well. And if there's anything embarrassing in your medical records, then you can be sure that person will read that. And if there's any possibility of them using the leverage that is provided to them by having a look at your benefit, your medical records, in order to resolve the benefit, the issue you've got with medical benefits, then the temptation is going to be there for them to do that. Alternatively, if you're in a situation where there is ever an occasion where you have any kind of an issue with the police, then you can be sure that the police will scan the National Police Database, which will be linked to the National Health Service Database, which will be linked to the Benefits Agency's database, and they will know everything about all aspects of your life, and also they will be able to link into the banking system. They'll also be able to link into the kind of databases that shops and businesses operate, because companies nowadays are required, particularly under the equalities equality acts, to conduct themselves in a way that is anti-fascist and anti-racist, and so therefore there is a requirement upon any organization that wants to deal with the government, wants to deal with any government departments, to operate databases and to conduct themselves in a very similar fashion to the way in which government will operate. And so what we're facing is a future where there are going to be all these various vested interest groups that are going to have interlocking databases, and everything that you do and everything you say and everything you spend money on and everywhere you go is going to be logged by people. And if you think that's a good thing, if you think that's going to be empowering for you, then turn a blind eye to it all and just proceed as if there's nothing wrong. But if you think that, hey, wait a minute, that's giving those people in charge, a tremendous amount of knowledge of me as an individual and a tremendous amount of power, because knowledge is power, and it will give those people a tremendous amount of power over you in order to use any issue that you've got in one aspect of your life to provide them with leverage over you in your issues that may arise with any other department, either of government or any other organization that links into the government databases.
It's incredibly intrusive, isn't it, when you think about it, and the way that it will all be interlocked and tracking you as well. I mean, people do all they can to prevent them being tracked on their phones and using virtual proxy servers so that you can't be traced online. But then if all your business transactions or your financial transactions are being logged, and your medical records and your police records, and it's all tied in together, and you've got commercial aspects to this as well, you've got Google and Apple and what have you that are managing this, plus you've got commercial bodies that the government have given these tenders out to in order to collate all this information, so it goes off to the insurance companies as well. I mean, it's a shocking intrusion into people's privacy. I mean, we've also got Hamza Yousaf, the Justice Secretary of the Scotland National Party, and he's talking about trying to criminalise what people say within their own homes, what people say at dinner parties. So it's not just that we're being tracked and they're keeping records of all this data. They're now specifically saying that they want to intrude within your own four walls at home and tell you what you can and cannot say, what you can and cannot criticize. And all I can say about this is this Hamza Yousaf has rightly been condemned for this, and the atheist society, the secular society, the religious people, the police, all these different representatives have said that this bill is unworkable, and it does away with the most fundamental British rights and values that we have had for centuries. So I'm hoping it's not actually going to get through, but the very fact that this guy can think that he can say that and think that the government could get away with doing that, and this is at the same time as giving a speech where he lists all these all the leaders in various industries that are actually white, and he says the word white, and you can tell he really hates white people when he's saying this. As if it's a shocking thing that all these directors and MPs and leaders of organisations, that they are actually white. Well, what would you expect in Scotland? You would expect them to be white. Scotland is 99% white. It's probably the whitest part of the United Kingdom when you think about it. It shouldn't come as a shock to him that these people are white. And what is he saying? He wants to replace them all with his own kind. He wants to replace all the white people with non-whites, and he wants to intrude in people's homes and take away their right to free speech within their own home. And then you think about the fact that you've children nowadays have got, they've got their smartphones, they've got their cameras on it, and they'll be filming, and they can upload what their parents have just said or whatever and get their parents into trouble. I mean, it's really sinister what is going on. It's not just the coronavirus, it's all these clampdowns on free speech. It's what's going on with the banks as well. I mean, it really is a time of great upheaval, I think. It ties in with all these predictions of the end times as well, I think. It's hard to know, to really predict what is going to happen, where the pushback against it is going to come from. We've got this this guy, Lawrence Fox, I believe his name is, who has been given a lot of money to start up a political party, which is going to be like sort of UKIP part two, and he seems to be a bit of an escape valve. We've got Patriotic Alternative, who've got their hands tied behind their backs at the moment because we can't have any gatherings of more than six people. So the whole year we haven't been able to really get together and brainstorm and improve our sense of community. But that's about all that I can really see that's positive is really this Lawrence Fox party and Patriotic Alternative that are pushing back against this. But I don't know if there's anything you want to add to that, Max. Do you want to?
I think individual people have just got to start to practice resistance to what's taking place, and it doesn't necessarily have to be aggressive resistance or anything of that sort of. It can just be it could just be civil disobedience, really, on that kind of a level. Because I mean, one of the things that's alarmed me just recently is the number of people that have got one of these Alexa things in their home where they just call out, Alexa, can you tell me when the Great Fire of London was, that kind of thing. And they encourage their children to use these Alexa things because, you know, children have traditionally, when they've been doing their homework, they sort of go to their parents and say, Mum, Dad, do you know when such and such happened? Or do you know this? Or do you know that, to help me with my paper, with my homework? And now, instead of doing that, what happens is that children are directed towards Alexa, and they're encouraged to ask Alexa for the answer to any problems that they've got or anything that they don't know. And yet these Alexa things are switched on 24/7, and they're listening to whatever's going on in your child's bedroom. Now, that information is going to be it's going to be processed and it's going to be logged by Google. When you get into your car and you put your sat nav on, because you don't really know exactly where the location is that you're going to be going to, and you say, Alexa, can you direct me to such and such and such and such? Now, that piece of information probably is going to be logged and recorded somewhere, and your location at the time when you make that request is going to be logged and recorded. And so we're going to be living in an era where, metaphorically speaking, we're all going to be living in a goldfish bowl with people who are the analysts that are working for all of these data processing companies, that they're going to be sort of watching us in our goldfish bowl and drawing any sort of conclusions from us. And as I say, if you're the sort of person who who is absolutely convinced that you never ever will have any issue with authority, then you've got nothing, I suppose, to worry about. And people turn around and they say, oh, well, if you don't break the law, you've got nothing to worry about. Well, yeah, if you think for the rest of your life you are never going to have an issue with any authority in this country, then you probably can relax and just think, oh, crikey, that's great. I'm just basking the fact that the authorities around you know everything about you and can sort of cater perhaps for your every need, if you think they might be motivated to do that. But the fact of the matter is that most of us can't say whether we're ever going to have any kind of an issue with authority, any kind of a confrontation with authority. And I'm not just, you know, it could be with the school teachers at your children's school. It could be with somebody who is giving you medical treatment. It could be with the police. It could be somebody who's dealing with a benefits claim that you might have, or anything of that sort. But you may have an issue with somebody at some point in the future. And what you've got to bear in mind is that when you have that issue with that person in future, they're going to know everything about you and you're going to know nothing about them. So who do you think is going to have the upper hand, you or them? I think it's going to be them. It's going to be them every time. And so we need to start thinking about taking these Alexa machines out and throwing them away, because we shouldn't want anybody to be listening into us 24/7. We should very reluctantly use SatNav, and only use SatNav in the most extreme cases when we just can't find the place we're looking for. We should only and we should be very careful about the privacy terms and conditions. And the point is that the people that operate all this automation, that operate all the computer systems, etc., that we use, and the programs and the software that we use as part of our everyday life, they know that when you sign up to use a service that they provide, and they ask you to tick a box to say that you've read the terms and conditions, they know that in 99.9% of the time, people aren't actually going to read all those terms and conditions, because the terms and conditions very often will run to something like 350 closely typed pages of A4 that you've got to scroll through, 90% of which, plus of which, is going to be, in fact, probably 99% of which is going to be just boring legalistic terminology. But the point is that the 1% that you don't bother to read, because you don't bother to read all the rest of it anyway, because it's just too much of a faff for you to read all this sort of stuff, that is going to contain the permission that enables them to use any information that they've gathered on you and pass it on to virtually anybody else that they see fit, basically. And so we're moving into this dangerous situation that we need to be very skeptical about.
Yeah, you bring up a good point there with the Alexa, I think, and the voice recognition. I think whenever I call up my bank, it automatically tries to get a recording of my voice and ask for permission to link my voice to the bank account. And I always press the no button because, you know, you don't want to have your voice linked up to your identity anywhere, because then if you are talking to Alexa and that is linked up, they will be able to identify exactly who it is that is talking to that Alexa. If you're around at somebody else's house and they've got their Alexa and it's on, that would then be able to pick up your voice and they would be able to identify that you were at their house. And you don't know how this information is going to be used. You can also think about the fact that when people are actually recording information, and I get this a lot with doctors, and they'll be recording information, and the information that they've actually recorded is wrong. And when you actually see the doctor's letters, there's mistakes in them. And it can't just be me, and it can't just be doctors that do this. When you've got people that are recording information, probably it happens in benefits as well. Whenever you have this interface with the authorities, there is going to be room for human error there. And that human error, if it was just stuck to that department in the past, then it could be rectified, and the only damage that it's going to cause is in that particular department if you don't actually get to rectify it. When you've got everything that's all linked up together, that has the potential to cause damage in various other areas in your life where everything is linked up in this way. I mean, I think some ways that we can resist against this is just by insisting on using cash. And I always use cash. And I've found that when I do say that I want to pay by cash, that normally the people are very pleased, because not so many people are using cash nowadays, and they may be short of coinage in the till and what have you. So I'd recommend that people use cash. That's one way that we can resist against this. Another way is to not give your permission, if you can. I mean, a lot of the times with these terms and conditions, you're forced to, really, if you want to make use of whatever the software is or whatever it is that you're wanting to make use of. They try and force you to acquiesce to these terms and conditions, but sometimes you don't have to. And it's a shocking state of affairs. I've got another news story that I'd like to bring up this week, which is actually to do with a different subject. And I did talk a little bit about something similar in the Daily Nationalist last week about the Yorkshire Museum and how they were putting blackface on our history. Yorkshire Museum were basically trying to tell us that the body of this woman that was in a burial mound was black because she came from North Africa. And the story should have been about how this body comes from North Africa, and that confirms our British history of the King of Africa, who was basically the King of the Vandals, coming over to England, conquering Ireland, and then making an alliance with the Saxons and kicking out the Welsh into Wales. It was a very important part of our history, and it's confirmed by this body being from North Africa. But Yorkshire Museum tried to say that because it was from North Africa, this woman had to be black. And this week we've got the same thing going on the television. And this is a recurring thing. And there's quite a few of these characters in our past that they have done this to, that they have put blackface on now. And the most recent one is actually Anne Boleyn, of all people. Black model Jodie Turner-Smith is set to play 16th century Queen of England Anne Boleyn, who was, of course, a white woman. In a statement, Channel 5 said the drama will explore the final months of Anne Boleyn's life from the eponymous Queen's perspective. The psychological drama follows her as she struggles to survive, to secure a future for her daughter, and to challenge the powerful patriarchy closing in around her. Anne, the mother of Elizabeth I, was executed in 1536 at the Tower of London after falling out of favour with the Tudor king and losing a battle at court with enemies such as Thomas Cromwell. And of course, this is very topical because she lost her head, and we've got all these beheadings that are going on at the moment. But the fact that they're trying to turn her into a feminist, and they're trying to portray this as Anne Boleyn challenging the powerful patriarchy closing in around her, and they're trying to portray her as black, and this isn't a light-skinned person of colour that they're using. The person that they're using is actually very, very, very dark-skinned. And when you think about when we have white actors, and if they put on blackface, then that's it, their career is destroyed. That is exactly what they're doing here. They are picking out characters in our past, from our history, and they're painting them in blackface. But by putting a black actor in the role of a white person in history, that black actor is essentially just being used to put blackface on that person from our past. It's incredibly insulting. I mean, and it's, as I say, last week I pointed out the fact that it was the museum that was doing this, who were supposed to be the guardians of our history and our heritage, and now we've got Channel 5 that are doing this, and there's been a big pushback against this, and people have been saying things like, are we going to have a white person to play Martin Luther King then? Of course they wouldn't allow that, but they think that this is absolutely wonderful doing this. It's just it's a shocking sign of the times, really, because they've done it to so many of our members of history now. I don't know, did you see this news story this week?
I did see the story, yes. And when you consider that, I mean, there have been a couple of very good film portrayals of Elizabeth I that have been created over recent times, and they have accurately portrayed Elizabeth I as being a very pale-skinned woman with red hair. And when you consider that to be a very pale-skinned person with red hair is probably just about as the opposite you could possibly get of being very, very dark-skinned and sort of African in appearance, that to feature a black actress in the role of Queen Elizabeth I's mother is just utterly ridiculous, and it just goes to show that what you've been saying is absolutely correct. But there is, and there has been, I think, since the rise of Black Lives Matter and the death of this chap whose name escapes me, who had the knee put on his neck, George Floyd, that's right, yeah. So George Floyd. Ever since then, there has been a massive acceleration of what used to be called blonking, which is getting blacks on camera, which is where people who are filming events or who are creating any kind of video production or whatever, where they try to include as many black people as possible in order to create the impression that at the time when this film was made or in the era that this film represents, if it's a period piece, that there was a very much larger non-white section of the population than there actually was. You know, that has gone into overdrive now, so that there are advertisements on TV where there is just not a single white person represented in the advertisement at all, where every single person is black, and this is happening more and more now. So and particularly with the links between one piece of TV production and the next TV program that comes on, the links will very often have somebody who's got a very distinctive non-white voice, who's obviously black or perhaps Caribbean or something like that, and you can it's very obvious that they're not a white person. And so and there's been a massive increase in the number of people who appear in news programs and current affairs programs where there are special correspondents, and the special correspondent from Birmingham will be somebody who's non-white, and then the special correspondent from New York will be somebody who's non-white, and then the special correspondent from I don't know, Russia or wherever it happens to be, will be somebody who's non-white, and this is happening to a massively disproportionate degree, and it's quite obvious that there is an attempt made on the part of our mass media to just deluge us in so much of this that younger generations will grow up believing that the key individuals from our past were black, that a disproportionately large number of people who took part in the historic events that formed Britain and that made us who we are and the nation that we are were black or non-white, and that black and non-white people contribute a disproportionate amount to the culture that we that we live within and practice and have today. And this is all very sinister, and it's another sinister aspect of what's taking place in Britain today.
Yeah, it's part of this big reset. They're completely changing our history as well. You know, this plays in with these turbulent times. They're completely rewriting our history so that youngsters today that watch these period dramas, they will assume that blacks and non-whites have been here all this time, and that royalty was black, like this Anne Boleyn. The story that I covered last week was saying that the Romans were black and were multicultural, and they're just stealing our history from us, basically stealing it from us and handing it over to other peoples. And the children of today, the ones that don't know any better, this is what they're being fed. And they're seeing that there are more and more non-whites in their classrooms, and they're just being told that they've always been here. Not that they've only been here for the last 70 years. In 1948, Britain was 99.8% white. So this idea that diversity built Britain, as it says on the 50p coin, is just a complete nonsense. And the only people that are really speaking up against it are us as nationalists. And we've now sort of changed from being activists and being political activists to now being the guardians of our heritage and the guardians of truth in history. It's a very important role, I think, that we are playing as nationalists and as activism, as it changes over the years. And it's changed from being out there on the streets and protesting to presenting programs and coming out with our own media. And now it's changing to we are the guardians of the truth in history, and just trying to get the truth of who we are out there, the custodians of our heritage. It's not just political nationalism is a creed. It takes over it informs every aspect of our lives. I think it's very important. Truth and history. Go on, Max.
And I think it's fair enough if there was an individual, there was an individual called Walter Tull, who was somebody of mixed race, who was a professional footballer in Britain during the early part of the 20th century. And he became, I don't know whether he was actually the first, but he was probably one of the first non-white people to receive a commission in the British Army. And he served in the British Army during the First World War. And I think he survived and went on to sort of play football again after the First World War. But the point is that if you are producing a film about the life of Walter Tull, that's fair enough. Show Walter Tull as being black, because that's where you're portraying the truth. But if you're showing a film which is supposed to be a typical view of the Western Front during the First World War, then the numbers of people who would have been non-white, who would have been participants in the fighting on the Western Front during the First World War, would have been minuscule, to the point where it would be barely worth counting the numbers compared with the numbers of them that would have been white. And so, therefore, to have any kind of a film where you portray large numbers of people as being non-white would be just completely false. And I think that the people that make our films need to be made to reflect those truths that yes, there was a very, very small number of people who were non-white that served for and that fought for Britain during the First World War. But as a generalism, the numbers of them compared with the numbers of people who were white is minuscule, to the point where they were, to all intents and purposes, irrelevant in terms of the effort they provided, and that the course of the First World War would not have been changed had they not existed. And what we've got to try and fight for is a media that represents the truth, rather than a media that massages the truth and which takes very, very extreme, unusual examples and tries to portray that extremely unusual example as being a general truth. And that's the issue that we've got to face here.
I think a
similar situation occurred with probably about 3 weeks or so back. There was a program about Mary Seaforth, or I can't quite remember what her name is now, but anyway, she was a lady who had run a hotel in the Caribbean, and she saw a business opportunity to start up another hotel just a few miles back from the front during the Crimean War, where she entertained officers primarily and provided them with hotel facilities and restaurant facilities. And she has now had a statue of her that has been placed outside of St. Thomas's Hospital, I think it is, which is within sight of the Houses of Parliament. And the statue that's been erected for her is 50% larger than the statue that was erected for Florence Nightingale, and 50% larger than the statue that was that was created for Edith Cavell, who was another woman who was one of the pioneers of nursing, and to the extent that again, history has been perverted in the sense that the way in which this film was produced and the way in which this statue has been created is such that it makes it appear that this woman overshadowed Florence Nightingale and Edith Cavell in the establishment of modern day nursing practices, which is just a travesty of the truth, basically.
Well, I think we need to identify it as blackface. I think that will help if we point out that when they're replacing white people in our past and pretending that they're black with black actors, that that's what it is. It's blackface. It's no different to having a white actor putting on black makeup. They're just using an actual black person to fulfill exactly that same role of pretending that somebody white is black.
Was actually of
I know that
West Indian and black origin, but she obviously was nowhere near as important in terms of establishing modern nursing than the likes of Florence Nightingale.
Yeah, I'm not sure of what her name is, but I did read about that. But they keep trying to insert black people into our history and highlighting minuscule people that were actually black and making out that they're much bigger than they actually were because they don't have any history of their own. If they had any history of their own, then they would be telling that history, and they're not. They're just trying to steal our history and steal our accomplishments. Anyway, let's get into our greatest Britons, a man who did make some great accomplishments in his life, General Gordon. We'll start with a recap from last week. We talked about his charity work when he came back into Britain, about how he gave away 90% of his annual income. We talked about how he never married, which in actual fact was quite common at the time, and you pointed out after we'd actually finished recording, Max, that Tesla didn't marry, Hitler didn't marry until right at the end, Rhodes didn't marry, and Lord Baden-Powell didn't actually marry until he was 65, and then he sired three children. So this shows us that being celibate was something that was actually quite common. It wasn't uncommon. It didn't mean that somebody was homosexual at all, because we've had these modern accusations that a lot of these people were homosexual simply because they were celibate. And you also pointed out, Max, that that gays would have remained celibate anyway back then. If they knew that they had these perverted desires, which is how it would have been seen back then they would have just done all they could to avoid any of those kinds of situations, and they would have been celibate. So the idea that he was homosexual is just really just an insult. We talked about how he rescued a girl from the Ottoman Pashas in Bulgaria, and one of our Bulgarian listeners was unable to find out more information about that, so it's obviously not a national myth or anything that's talked about now. And then we talked about how he was in Egypt and he was promoted to colonel and he was made the governor of Equatoria. And once he was made the governor of Equatoria, he really fought against the slave trade. And this was despite his superiors who were supporting it. And every time that he freed these slaves and sent them back so that they could then be sent back to where they originally came from, his superiors were then enslaving them again and selling them on again. And this really shows us what the British Empire's role in the world was. It was trying to make life better for the peoples of these third world countries. It wasn't about oppressing them. It was about trying to do away with the corruption that was actually in these nations. I don't know if you want to add any more to that, Max, or anything that you want to bring up to do with that.
Well, I think your recollection of the conversation we had last week is absolutely spot on. I think in times gone by, sexuality and aspects of sex were not as central to the culture that existed, certainly back in the early part of the 20th century and earlier than that. And so therefore, if a man found that he was going to lead a life that would require him to place his life in danger on a regular basis, and where he would not be able to lead a normal life such that it would be conducive to married life, then men quite often would just defer getting married, or would decide not to get married, and they would pursue their career in order to make their mark in history. And then only once they had done that would they then perhaps look around in the way that Lord Baden-Powell did, and think, well, you know, am I too late to have a family and to enter into married life, or am I not? And in the case of Lord Baden-Powell, he decided that he wasn't too late, and he married at what most people would regard as quite an advanced age, at something like 65 years of age. And as you report, you know, he did father three children beyond that, which shows that he was, even at the age of 65, still a very virile man, and somebody who was a virile heterosexual rather than a homosexual. And so when people turn around and they say, oh, so-and-so in, you know, that era in time had remained celibate throughout the whole of their life, it doesn't indicate that there is anything more sort of obscure that you need to sort of look for to explain that. It is just something that men did because of the needs of their time. And I think even as far as Hitler is concerned, Hitler wrote in Mein Kampf that he had never married for two reasons, really. And the one reason was that he felt that the fact that he was single created a greater attraction for women in him, but also that secondly, the life he led was so dangerous that it wouldn't have been conducive to married life, and it would have weakened his position, and it would have placed anybody that was very close to him, a wife or children, it would have placed them in danger. And so that's why he remained a single man for as long as he did.
We have to be careful not to project today's sensibilities really on the past. There's good points there that you bring up, Max. Mm. Well, Gordon then headed back to London, and he was asked to work for King Leopold of Belgium in the Congo, but he's persuaded to head back to the Sudan by the rich Khedive Ismail Pasha, who was this very rich person that actually got his country into a lot of debt. And we'll find out more about him in today's episode. Gordon agreed to return to Cairo and was asked to take the position of Governor General of the entire Sudan, which he accepted. And he now received the honorific rank and title of Pasha in the Ottoman aristocracy. And as governor, Gordon faced a variety of challenges. Besides working to end slavery, Gordon carried out a series of reforms, such as abolishing torture and public floggings, where those opposed to the Egyptian state were flogged with a whip known as the courbash, made of buffalo hide. The reforms that Gordon wanted would have changed the basic nature of the Ottoman-Egyptian rule by replacing a system based on exploitation of the people by the state with one where the state would work for the betterment of the people. These aims unfortunately eluded him, however. Gordon himself was honest and incorruptible, but he was almost alone in possessing those qualities, and the venal and corrupt Egyptian bureaucrats usually ignored his orders when they conflicted with the chance to make a quick buck. Unfortunately, most of the Europeans who the Egyptians had hired to work as civil servants in the Sudan were no better, and proved to be just as corrupt as the Egyptians. The bribes that the slave traders offered for bureaucrats to turn a blind eye to the slave trade had far more effect on the bureaucrats than did any of Gordon's offers to suppress the slave trade, which were simply ignored. Lisergio Santoni, an Italian hired by the Egyptian state to run the Sudanese post office, wrote about Gordon's time as governor general that, as his exertions were not supported by his subordinates, his efforts remained fruitless. This man's activity, with the scientific knowledge which he possesses, is doubtless able to achieve much, but unfortunately no one backs him up, and his orders are badly carried out or altered in such a way as to render them without effect. All the Europeans, with some rare exceptions, whom he has honoured with his confidence, have cheated him. Reflecting these realities, Gordon had to undertake much of the administrative work himself, travelling ceaselessly and constantly all over the Sudan via a camel in attempts to make the bureaucracy actually obey his orders, something that occurred when he was present but stopped as soon as he left. Gordon was as well known for being utterly obstinate as he was for riding his camel, joking that the Gordons and the camels are of the same race. Let them take an idea into their heads and nothing will take it out. I have a splendid camel, none like it. It flies along and quite astonishes the Arabs. Gordon's reforming zeal would make him popular with the ordinary people of the Sudan. As one observer noted, whenever he left and entered the governor's palace in Khartoum, government officials, consular agents and native people awaited him in large numbers, and they celebrated His Excellency's arrival with an indescribable uproar. So we see a man there that is really popular with the people, and he's trying to do his best by these people, and that they're not his own people. These are the Sudanese and these are the Arabs, and unfortunately the actual people that he's working for are just too corrupt, and they're not helping him out in any way. I mean, this must have been really soul-destroying for him, trying to get rid of this slave trade, this horrific slave trade, and the bureaucrats just keep turning a blind eye to it, and he's been employed to actually do this. He's not even taking his full wage. He's only taking about 20% of the wages that he was actually offered for this. He's doing it out of a love of humanity, really, and he's just not getting anywhere with it. And he does manage to abolish torture and public floggings, which is good. But again, that's something that we still see that goes on today in Saudi Arabia. You know, what was going on back then under Ottoman Egyptian rule is the same sort of thing that we see today still happening in these Muslim countries. And all this time we've wanted to put a stop to it. There have been good British people, good British men that have gone out there in the British Empire trying to make life better for the people that they were ruling over. They were not out there to oppress them. Do you have any thoughts on Gordon here in Sudan, Max?
Well, I think we said last week, or it might have been the week before when we were talking about Gordon, that he kind of exhibited the characteristics that one would hope to have in a king. And I think that he's the sort of person who, had he been a self-serving person, he could have established himself as a king in somewhere like China, where he served for a while. But also he would appear to have been able to have established himself as a king in the Sudan as well, had he been somebody who was promoting his own personal self-interest. But you know, quite clearly, he was one of the people who believed that the administration that was provided by the British Empire under the British system of government that prevailed at the time, which was, in comparison with today, largely uncorruptible, that he firmly believed that that was in the interests of the people that were under his sway, and he behaved in a thoroughly upstanding way, and in a way which was in the best interest of the people who were in his care. And the point is that it's ironic that nowadays, with the likes of Black Lives Matter, etc., that he would be the kind of person where they would campaign to have his statue torn down, and they would beat his statue with clubs and rocks in order to deface it and throw it in the river if they had the opportunity. And yet he is the sort of person that really ought to be celebrated as an almost saintly personality, in my view.
He should really be lionized and also put up as an example of this is what people were like in the British Empire. Yes, there were some corrupt people, but there were also very good people. And we'll see in this next bit that as well as looking out for the best interests of the natives, he was also against the banks. In 1876, Egypt went bankrupt. A group of European financial commissioners led by Evelyn Baring, so he must be from Baring's bank, I take it, took charge of the Egyptian finances in an attempt to pay off the European banks who had lent so much money to Egypt. With the country bankrupt, the money to carry out the reforms Gordon wanted just was not there. With over half of Egypt's income going to pay the 7% interest on the debt worth 81 million Egyptian pounds that Ismail had run up, the Khedive was supportive of Gordon's plans for reform, but unable to do very much, as he lacked the money to pay his civil servants and soldiers in Egypt, much less so in the Sudan. Gordon travelled north to Cairo to meet with Baring and suggest a solution that Egypt suspend its interest payments for several years to allow Ismail to pay the arrears owed to his soldiers and civil servants, arguing that once the Egyptian government was stabilised, then Egypt could start paying its debts without fear of causing a revolution. Gordon's plans were far-sighted and humane. But Baring had no interest in Gordon's plans to suspend the interest payments, being a typical banker. Gordon disliked Baring, writing that he had a pretentious, grand, patronising way around him. We had a few words together. When oil mixes with water, we will mix together. So you see, Gordon's got quite a sensible idea here. You don't want this country to fall to Islamic radicals. You don't want there to be a civil war. You're not going to get your money back if it becomes a failed state. The thing to do is to just suspend the interest on the debt. But the bankers don't want to do that because they want to take everything. They want to take all the property, everything that was put up as collateral on the debt. They want to own the country. What we see today, we see the World Bank and the IMF telling these countries that they loan to that they have to bring in human rights, they have to promote homosexuality, they have to promote diversity, they have to tax the middle classes. All these things that we see that are harmful are being forced on these countries by the World Bank and the IMF in exchange for this money that they actually loan to them. And we see here that the way the banks make their money is purely out of this interest. And half the money from Egypt, half the gross domestic product that was created by Egypt was all having to go just on the interest of this debt. And that was just a 7% interest. And it was taking up half of all the money that the country could produce. So you can see that there is this incentive there for them to keep up the slavery, really, because they've got to try and make the money somehow. And that was the main way of making money in Africa. So you can see why they didn't want to give up slavery. They got these huge debts to the banks. And what else is there that they can produce other than other slaves? So you got quite a situation there. And I do like the fact that he didn't get on with the bankers and he had this good idea. Max, comment on this?
No, I thoroughly agree with what you said there, actually. I believe it exactly the way to interpret what you've just recounted. And it is, again, another feather in Gordon's cap that he did try to resist the bankers, and he wasn't prepared to see Egypt impoverished just simply in the interests of the banks.
Yeah, he knew what would happen if the civil servants weren't paid and if the army weren't paid, you would get chaos and you would get a failed state. Well, slavery was the basis of the Sudanese economy, and Gordon's attempts to end the slave trade meant taking on some very powerful vested interests, most notably Rahama Zobier, known as the King of the Slavers, as he was the richest and most powerful of all the slave traders in the entire Sudan. An insurrection had broken out in Darfur province, led by associates of Zobier, and Gordon went to deal with it. The insurgents were numerous, and he saw that diplomacy had a better chance of success. On the 2nd of September 1877, Gordon, clad in the full gold-braided ceremonial blue uniform of the Governor-General of the Sudan, and wearing the tarbrush, the type of fez reserved for a pasha, accompanied by an interpreter and a few bashi bazooks, he rode unannounced right into the enemy camp to discuss the situation. Gordon carried no weapons except for his rattan cane, although the bashi bazooks were armed with rifles and swords, but showed absolutely no fear, while his interpreter and the bashi bazooks were visibly showing their nerves as the rebels numbered about 3,000. Gordon was met by Suleiman Zobier, the son of Rahama Zobier, and demanded in the name of the Khedive of Egypt that the rebels end their rebellion and accept the authority of their lord and master, telling Zobier that he would disarm and break them if the rebellion did not end at once. Gordon also promised that those rebels who laid down their arms would not be punished and would all be given jobs in the administration. A tense standoff ensued, and though the rebels could have easily killed Gordon and his party, as Gordon wrote in a letter to his sister, the rebels were all dumbfounded at my coming among them. This bold move proved successful, as one chief and then another pledged his loyalty to the Khedive, including Suleiman Zobir himself, although the remainder retreated to the south. Zobir the Slaver would later turn renegade, though, and on the 15th of July 1879, Gordon's associate Gessi finally captured Zobir together with 250 of his men. As Zobir had broken his oath to the Khedive by rebelling, Gordon gave Gessi orders to execute Zobir, and later that day Gessi had Zobir and his men publicly beheaded as an example of what happened to those men who broke their oaths. So again, we see his courage there, going in there completely unarmed and deciding that diplomacy is the way to deal with this, British diplomacy, to avoid a massacre, and then taking these people on in the administration. They were obviously business-minded, even if what they were involved in was the slave trade. I'm sure they probably would have been quite good at working in the administration here. And again, we see the importance of keeping to your oath. And all these men were publicly beheaded for breaking their oath as well. And you can see he's got a huge reputation now, hasn't he? And he could have made himself king.
Yeah, I mean, to go in amongst them unarmed in the way that he did basically demonstrated that he had tremendous confidence in his ability to resist any kind of attack that they might throw against him, and that obviously unnerved them, and that's the reason why a number of them immediately pledged their loyalty to the Khedive.
Oh, yeah, he must have had a huge sense of authority. Well, Gordon then tried another peace mission to Abyssinia, which was at war with Egypt. The matter ended with Gordon's imprisonment and transfer to Massawa. From there, he returned to Cairo and resigned his Sudan appointment, being exhausted by years of incessant work. Gordon had gone to the Sudan with high hopes that via his iron will and Christian faith, he would defeat the Ottoman-Egyptian system of rule, that he would act as a reformer who would change the system from within to make what was unjust just, and that he would make things better for the ordinary people of the Sudan. Instead, the Ottoman-Egyptian system had defeated him, with almost all of Gordon's reforms having failed owing to the venality of the bureaucracy, who shared absolutely none of Gordon's moral outrage at slavery and injustice, and Gordon's dreams of making things better for the ordinary people were dissolved in the face of greed and the self-interest of others. The system remained the same, creaking, slow, utterly corrupt, an oppressive apparatus, trampling down ordinary people the same as it had always been. At the end of his governor generalship of the Sudan, Gordon had to admit that he had been a failure, an experience of defeat that so shattered him that he had a nervous breakdown. As he travelled via Egypt to take the steamer back to Britain, a man who met him in Cairo described Gordon as a broken man who was rather off his head. Before Gordon boarded the ship at Alexandria that was to take him home, he sent off a series of long telegrams to various ministers in London, full of biblical verses and quotations that he claimed offered the solution to all of the problems of modern life. I think possibly part of this breakdown could have been caused by his imprisonment, because that must have been pretty harsh, being imprisoned when he went to Abyssinia to try and make peace between Abyssinia and Egypt. You would hope that he would be treated like, you know, respectfully as the Pasha that he was, high up in the Ottoman Empire. But you just don't know, do you, with these prisons there? And obviously, it must have really, really hurt him that he had done all this work, and he's got all these, you know, he's done so many good deeds, and he's got such a good moral character, and he just wants to do the best for these people, and it just all failed. Unfortunately, do you want to add anything to that, Max?
Well, just really that one man can't necessarily take on an entire system and reform the system. That it very often takes other people to join them, and in order to make their reforms work. And I think this is sort of fairly clear in this particular instance.
Yeah, you can only do so much if you're on your own. You've got to have the rest of the people working with you rather than against you. Well, after recovering and turning down various positions, he was invited to Beijing by Sir Robert Hart, the Inspector General of Customs in China, saying his services were urgently needed in China, as Russia and China were on the verge of war. Gordon was nostalgic for China, and knowing of the Sino-Russian crisis, he saw a chance to do something significant. The British diplomat Thomas Francis Wade reported, "The Chinese government still holds Gordon Pasha in high regard, and they were anxious to have him back to fight against Russia if war should break out." An exchange of telegrams ensued between the War Office in London and Gordon in Bombay about just what exactly he was planning on doing in China. And when Gordon replied that he would find out when he got there, Gordon was ordered to stay. Gordon then disobeyed orders and left on the first ship to China, an action that very much angered the army's commander, the Duke of Cambridge. Gordon arrived in Shanghai in July and met Li Hongzhang and learned that there was a risk of war with Russia. After meeting his old friend, Gordon assured Li that if Russia should attack, he would resign his commission in the British Army to take up a commission in the Chinese Army, an action that, if taken, risked prosecution under the Foreign Enlistments Act. Gordon informed the Foreign Office that he was willing to renounce his British citizenship and take Chinese citizenship, as he would not abandon Li and his other Chinese friends should a Sino-Russian war begin. Gordon's willingness to renounce his British citizenship in order to fight with China in the event of war did much to raise his prestige in China. He proceeded to Beijing, where he clashed repeatedly with Prince Chun, the leader of the War Party, who rejected Gordon's advice to seek a compromise solution, as Gordon warned that the powerful Russian naval squadron in the Yellow Sea would allow the Russians to land at Tianjin and advance on Beijing. At one point during a meeting with the Council of Ministers, an enraged Gordon picked up a Chinese-English dictionary, looked up the word idiocy, and then pointed at the equivalent Chinese word with one hand while pointing at the ministers with the other. Gordon further advised the King Court that it was unwise for the Manchu elite to live apart from and treat the Han Chinese majority as something less than human, warning that this not only weakened China in the present, but would cause a revolution in the future. After speaking so bluntly, Gordon was ordered out of the court and Beijing, but he was allowed to stay at Tianjin. He was then ordered home by London, as the Foreign Office was not comfortable with the idea of him commanding the Chinese army against Russia if war should break out, believing that this could cause an Anglo-Russian war, and Gordon was told that he would be dishonorably discharged if he remained in China. Though the King Court rejected Gordon's advice to seek a compromise with Russia in the summer of 1880, Gordon's assessment of China's military backwardness and his stark warnings that the Russians would win if a war did break out played an important role in ultimately strengthening the peace party at the court, and it did prevent war from breaking out. So you see there that he's pushing for diplomacy rather than for war, and he's got his loyalties to these Chinese people here. I mean, hard to say whether that's right to say that he would resign his citizenship from Britain to go and help with the Chinese, but I guess morally he saw that was the right thing to do.
I guess he saw that there was no pressing threat to Britain at a point in time, whereas there was a pressing threat to China and the people that he had built up a link and obviously an affection for.
And it wasn't just the Chinese and the Sudanese that he cared about. He also had an incident in Ireland. When Gordon returned to Britain in October 1880, he paid a two-week visit to Ireland, landing at Cork and travelling over much of the island. He was sickened by the poverty of the Irish farmers, which led him to write a six-page memo to the Prime Minister, William Gladstone, urging land reforms in Ireland. Gordon wrote, "The peasantry of the northwest and southwest of Ireland are much worse off than any of the inhabitants of Bulgaria, Asia Minor, China, India, or the Sudan." Having been to all of those places and thus speaking with some authority, Gordon announced the scandal of poverty in Ireland could only be ended if the government were to buy the land of the ascendancy families, as the Anglo-Irish elite was known, and give it to the poor Irish tenant farmers. Gordon compared his plans for rural reform in Ireland to ending slavery in the British Empire in 1833, and ended his letter with the claim that if this was done, the unity of the United Kingdom would be preserved, as the Irish would appreciate this great act of justice, and the Irish independence movement would cease to exist, as they would have nothing more to seek from agitation. Somewhat tactlessly, Gordon reminded Gladstone that his father had owned a slave plantation in Jamaica and had been one of those slave owners compensated by the Crown in 1833 for the freeing of his slaves, a bit of Gladstone family history that the Prime Minister did not like to have discussed. So again, he's saying a lot of sensible things here. And you look at all the problems that we've had in Ireland and Northern Ireland ever since. And this really shows you how badly the Irish were treated. If he's saying that they were far worse off than the inhabitants of the Sudan, India, China, Bulgaria and Asia Minor, then they must have been in a very bad way. What do you make of Gordon in Ireland here, Max?
Well, I would say that it's tragic, really, that nobody took any notice of him at that particular point in time. And because when you consider the problems that the Troubles have created, when you consider that the weakening of Britain as a result of losing Southern Ireland, and also the weakening of our position internationally and in terms of our ability to bargain with the European Union as a result of losing Southern Ireland and having Southern Ireland be allied to the rest of Europe against Britain, that is a massive loss to us as a nation, and it's something which had only Gladstone been prepared to listen to Gordon and had taken an interest in what Gordon was saying, then all of that could have been averted, and we might find ourselves today in a much, much stronger position.
Yeah, Gladstone really doesn't sound too good, as we'll see in the next episode. He has a big run-in with Gladstone, and really, I think what happened to Gordon could have been responsible for the end of Gladstone. But we can see here that he's already got off on the wrong foot with him by reminding him that his money came from slave plantations, and that the slave masters were paid out. They were paid for. So why won't they pay out the Anglo-Irish elite and buy the lands from them in the same way that they bought the slaves from the people in America? Again, it's the same thing as a lot of people have pointed out. Why were the British so concerned with the treatment of the blacks in America and not concerned with the treatment of essentially white slavery that was going on in Britain at the time? Why was that? Yeah. And that's what Gordon is really pointing out there by highlighting Gladstone's links to slavery. Well, next week we will get into Gordon's war against the Islamic State, I think, and we will leave it there. So thank you very much for coming on today, Max.
Yeah, great pleasure. I've also looked up whilst we were talking that the name of this lady that I couldn't recall from earlier on, it's Mary C. Cole.
Ah, yes. I think it's not Mary Seacole. Yeah, Mary Seacole. Well, thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Real Britannia for you. And until then, of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.